Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to Renee's Heart to Heart. This is Renee. I'm glad you could join us today. Today is Bullies to Buddies Day, and that is what we're going to talk about, but I first have another subject that I came across last night during my research. And even though I'm not prepared to do a whole show about it, I did think that it was important to bring it up because there may be people out there that haven't seen anything about this and are maybe struggling with this same issue. And that is the fact that a lot of people, not just women, some are men as well, have kept a lifelong secret, a secret that I'm sure has caused them mental issues as well as physical problems. Because keeping secrets, bad secrets, secrets that hurt you, secrets that affected your well-being and the rest of your life tend to fester inside of you. So out of the blue, as I said, I was just doing some research. I wanted to see how our little friend Shahai was, the young woman who was proclaimed brain dead after a tonsillectomy. And on that note, I found a very interesting video that somebody had placed on Facebook and then taken off, but it's still on YouTube. And I was able to see it when I was looking through my my various news realms, Fox, CNN, NBC, all of those. It's an actual video of somebody with a piece of ice in their hand touching a child's feet that appears to be asleep. They don't show the rest of the body. They just show the feet. And when the ice touches the feet move. And, of course, lots of controversy, and they did take it off Facebook, but it is still available on YouTube. And there's a voice saying, how could somebody be gone if they feel the cold? So there is some controversy over whether or not it's really Shahai or just a means of support, perhaps, somebody doing this to let people know that they're not forgetting and that they're still waiting for a miracle. But I thought it was kind of gave me a funny feeling in my stomach because I'm torn as to whether or not it was a true video. So I'll keep researching on that. But what I did find while I was looking through everything is there was a young woman who suffered sexual abuse and privately was seduced by a teacher when she was very young. This was 16 years ago. And she had just stuffed it inside. And now she's an adult. She has children. So one day, just in passing, apparently, she realized that her aggressive seducer when she was a child had become a vice principal at a local school. So she you know, had great turmoil over what she wanted to do about it. And according to the interview I watched, she felt as though doing something about it was going to in some way protect her own children. And, of course, I understand that thought process a lot. So she videotaped herself calling this woman on the phone and calling her out. And the woman admitted to everything, did not deny anything. And she lost her job at the school. And the the time to be able to do anything to her, legally speaking, has passed. But she probably will never get another job in a school district, which is a good thing. But as I researched, I found out there were quite a few stories like this of somebody having this happen to them at a young age, not sharing it with anyone, keeping this horrific secret until they become old enough and secure enough to share it with somebody. And in some of the stories I read, it took a very, very long time. And of course, we've all we've all seen some of the shows where even Oprah Winfrey admitted to the fact that she had been sexually abused as a child in her own family, and often that is where it takes place. But a teacher, of course, for whatever reasons, just because of the way we all think, seems worse. So I want to say that if there's anybody out there that is keeping a secret like that, that's like keeping a really, really big infection inside of you. So if you don't have the kind of support where you can talk to somebody like that, see somebody who can keep secrets for you. Because keeping a secret for someone else is not as detrimental to your health as hanging on to your own bad secrets. I hope that makes sense to people, and I hope you understand what I'm saying. If you hang on to something that hurt you so deeply, it isn't good for you. You have to get rid of it. So give it to what I like to call the people that are secret keepers. I'm one of those. Secret keepers, keeping a secret like that for somebody else doesn't fester inside of you. It's someone else's secret. So please, don't let something like that stay inside of you. Get rid of it, even if all you can do is write it on a piece of paper. A lot of people believe in doing that. I don't see anything wrong with that either. At least then you're not the only one who's holding it. So today is going to be Bullies to Buddies. I did want to touch on that, and if there's any generated interest in that topic, or if there's somebody out there who would like to talk about that again for whatever reasons, whether it's personal or something that you know about, I'd love to hear from you. You can always call in the show at 347-989-0352, or you can always contact me on Facebook, Renee Brewer's Facebook. So for this morning, though, we're not going to talk about that anymore because it could be a very, very big topic, and if there is some generated interest to do a show on it, we will do that. In the interim, I'm going to invite Miss Shelley in so that we can go through our Bullies to Buddies workbook today. Good morning, Shel.
Good morning, Rainey.
How are you?
I'm doing good. You're considering doing a show on like people keeping secrets? Is that what you were saying, if there's generated interest?
Mm-hmm. Well, secrets like, you know, molestation, harm that was done to somebody, or a secret that they know.
Right, right.
But sometimes a child will keep a secret for someone else as well.
Right, right.
When I watched this video last night, this is a young, beautiful woman with children, a husband. She's okay. But when she found out that this woman who molested her and got her to trust her and made her believe that it was all okay. And then, of course, as she grew up, she realized it wasn't.
Wasn't, right.
You know, so she confronted her on the phone and videoed the whole thing. It was really quite dramatic.
Wow.
And the woman didn't deny anything. I mean, she didn't say, oh, you have the wrong person. I don't know what you're talking about. She was like, yes, yes, I did that. I know. So it led me to believe, and of course I know because of all the people that I've spent time with and the things people have shared with me, that a lot of people carry very burdumsun, that's the way you say it, memories and secrets that are harmful to their health. So, and there are many secret keepers. There's doctors, there's good friends, there's even moms and dads that can keep a secret for you if you don't want the rest of the world to know about it. But then it's not, you know, it's not so heavy on your heart. So my suggestion is to share it, and at the very least, write it on a piece of paper and put it someplace else so you're not the only one holding it.
And
so,
a lot of times, like you said, we'll do this. Mm-hmm. This would be a topic for another show, but a lot of times people keep secrets like that either because they've made a promise to the individual at a time when they didn't understand what that promise meant, or because they're ashamed and they believe that somehow they were at cause for why that was done to them. So it's, and then, like you said, as they get older and they start realizing that, no, it wasn't their fault and that, you know, that they shouldn't have made that promise to that person, and then it surfaces at some point when they're older and they're able to kind of really rationalize it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then, you know, then they can also rationalize is a good word to sum up what has to be done. And to be able to assess it as an adult is always helpful as well, you know, just to look at it for what it's worth. And now you know more, you understand more, you get that it was wrong, but you really don't know what to do with it yet. And
well, you know, without going into a lot of detail, because I want us to get into the bullies and buddies, but I had been inappropriately touched by one of my father's friends when I was very, very young. I think I was 7 or 8 years old. And I didn't really understand what he was doing. It was just one incident. It didn't traumatize me, but it did cause some other issues for me years later because I was very uncomfortable. And he was just telling me it was okay. He hit my dad actually left me with him for an hour when he had to run an errand without realizing what this guy was like. But I didn't find out until almost 5 years later. I was 13 years old, and I was watching a talk show with my mom and my sister, and they were talking about molestation. And I was like, it took 5 years. I never thought about it after that day. It never crossed my mind. I remembered how uncomfortable I was, and he kept telling me it was okay. And it wasn't until 5 years later that it dawned on me that something even happened to me, because it, like, happened and stopped happening. Now, maybe if he had been a relative and I had been seeing him often and it kept happening, it would have been traumatic. It would have had a different impact on me. But it took 5 years for me to realize that what happened to me that day wasn't right, and that that this guy wasn't just being friendly with me. And it was quite an eye-opener. All of a sudden, I'm sitting there in the room with my mother and my sister, and I went like, oh, my God, that happened to me. And then I got angry because then I realized what happened to me wasn't, like, okay. But at 8 years old, I didn't recognize that. All I remembered is being very, very uncomfortable.
And you were eight. That's pretty young, although not as young as I see some of the things that happen to kids. We've disconnected again from Shell, folks. I think we're all going to have to take up a collection and get her a new phone line. I don't think it's her phone. I think it's because out here in the acreage we have major issues with all of our technical stuff. My computer's been terrible lately.
Yeah, I'm back.
Okay. So today I'm gonna peruse something that Izzy has written. I got a great newsletter from him this week too that talks about lots of different things that is very interesting. And if anybody's interested in getting Izzy's newsletters, I would be happy. Shell, I don't know why I didn't think to do this for you, but I can send you the email so that you can read his newsletters. They're always very entertaining and sometimes a little funny, but always full of good news and controversial.
Or is it something he's sending you directly?
It's a part of me doing that that class. I signed up for the newsletter when I was there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. All right.
So this chapter is about why your anti-bullying program isn't working. And we've talked about this before, and I think Izzy's way of looking at it is the most appropriate, because he's right. Nobody likes to be told on. Nobody likes everybody else getting involved, so it often makes the situation much greater. Our nation's schools have been intensively fighting bullying for over 14 years. Since the Columbine shooting brought the problem of bullying to the public's consciousness. Every state in the nation has passed a tough school anti-bullying law. Thus, there is a good chance that as a school mental health professional, you are involved in implementing anti-bullying programs and policies. If it's not broken, don't fix it. If you're happy with the results of your anti-bullying efforts, keep doing what you're doing. However, research studies on intensive whole school anti-bullying programs show that they often produce little benefit or even lead to an increase in bullying. The anti-bullying field was created by Professor Dan Alvaeus of Norway. And Professor Alvaeus is one of the first people I ever talked about on the show. When I first started researching about bullying laws and what was already being done to stop bullying or to manage bullying, he's the first one that comes up, Dr. Alvaeus. The program he created, now known as the Alvaeus Bullying Prevention Program, is promoted by the major psychological organizations as the gold standard. Alvaeus reported a 50% reduction in bullying after 2 years of implementation of his program in Scandinavia in the 1980s. All popular anti-bullying programs are based on his teachings. They vary only in the details and the emphasis. Alvaeus and his followers have successfully lobbied for laws that require schools to use his definition and general recommendations. However, Alvaeus's original results of a 50% reduction in bullying have not been replicated anywhere else. A recent study found that students who go to schools that have anti-bullying programs are more likely to be bullied than kids in schools who don't have anti-bullying programs at all. The most massive study of the Alvaeus Bullying Prevention Program was recently conducted in Pennsylvania. It found a 12% reduction in the number of kids who report being bullied twice or more a month. A large-scale study of positive behavior interventions and supports was recently conducted by Johns Hopkins University. Bullying went up during the study. The program was deemed a success because bullying went up a little more in the control groups. A large-scale study of steps to respect found that bullying went up during the study. It, too, was deemed a success because bullying went up a little more in the control group. See, so
why it's being deemed a success if bullying is going up. What are they talking about?
Because they're getting the attention. They're seeing changes. So when they conduct any kind of a almost like an experimental procedure, and they see a change, then the prognosis is that it's going to make a difference in the long run if we keep studying this, or if we keep using this, you know, this program and bringing to light the bullying. Of course,
it's success because it showed that it can be affected by behavior, but not success as a solution to stop it.
Exactly. But they see a change. You know, it's like anything else. If you're talking to a, I don't know how to really explain this other than to say something really simple. If you can't get somebody's attention at all, you can't get somebody to even, you know, pay attention to what you're talking about. Imagine you're in front of an auditorium with 300 kids, and they're all talking and throwing paper and screaming and listening to music, and everybody's on their iPhones, and you can't get their attention at all. And you do stand up there one day, and you say something, and you get their attention, and you stop all that noise. That's successful. Scary,
mm-hmm.
isn't it? But that still denotes some kind of success and shows you that you might be headed in the right direction. So I think that's how a lot of these statistics are generated. They see a change, and change, even when it's not necessarily going in the right direction, in the good direction, it still means you've got somebody's attention. You know?
Yeah, but
I mean, have you ever dealt with a kid that's got a behavioral problem?
Right, this is where people get fooled by statistical
mm-hmm.
results of something. Because if somebody says this is a success, they think that means, most parents are going to say, oh, well, that means that they've cut down on the bullying in that school, all right? And if the bullying actually went up, they don't realize that the success is being based on a parameter that has nothing to do with the outcome that people are looking for. Because if the bullying went up, it means that the solution they got isn't working. Doesn't mean it is working. It means that they're actually inciting more bullying activity by their policies and protocols. So it's like a false positive, in other words, because
mm-hmm.
they put something into the criteria that shouldn't be there. We don't want to get these kids' attention. We want these kids to be more respectful of other kids. You know, just
mm-hmm.
getting their attention is not the answer. We have to get their attention and inspire them not to act that way, not make them want to act that way more. That's a failure. And that's where a lot of times these statistical reports, and they say, oh, yeah, this test was a success, and then you find out what they mean by a success, you know, it's kind of like a false positive.
Well, I think, like I said, when you spend a whole bunch of money to conduct any kind of a survey or evaluate a new program or something like that, any changes are viewed as success because it means you got people's attention. And then comes the time of, you know, honing down or reevaluating how you said something and changing it enough to make it even more successful. So it's not a bad thought, and it's not meant to mislead people. But I think that when somebody reads an evaluation like that and says, oh, you know, 15% of the kids, you know, listen to us and talk to us. Well, that's nice. But it's up to you to realize that that doesn't mean a damn thing. That, yes, maybe we're on the right track, but no, maybe we're not. There's still lots of testing and evaluations to do. So I don't think it's done to totally mislead the public. I think when you get grants and things like that to be able to do some evaluations like this and to do some, you know, take a whole school and teach them a new program and have all that going against you, you have to show that you got somebody's attention. So I don't think it comes from a bad place, but it is misleading, and it's not, but we as the consumers, we as the people that are reading these things, we're the ones that have to pay attention to what we're reading and take from it what it really means. So
well, the reason I react that way is because that's like what pharmaceutical companies do, and that's what a lot of companies that want to market a particular product in a particular area, all they have to do is basically manipulate the criteria, which means the things that they're going to use to say whether or not this was a success or not. They can take that list of criteria and manipulate it until they get enough criteria so that they can say it was a success. Meanwhile, some of the things they take out or put in have nothing to do with the actual success or benefit of that product or service. So, I mean, I see this done a lot in marketing campaigns. And if these schools are getting grant money to do these tests and they're reporting a success when the thing they're trying to diminish goes up, I can't help it. To me, that's misleading. And that's just because they want additional grant monies or they want to keep running with this. But if the bullying is going up, again, like I said, this isn't about getting anybody's attention. Because if you get a bully's attention and you inspire him to bully more, then your solution is not working. This is something that Izzy talks about all the time, that a lot of schools have policies that sound like they should work, but they actually make the situation work. But they hold on to these policies because they seem to make sense, you know, and that's the danger in saying that they're successful, when actually you see a spike in bullying and they ignore that because it sounds like a sound principle. It makes sense that if you got a kid bullying another kid, you should call them in and reprimand them and maybe suspend them or something. But that type of activity can actually make it worse, you know. But it sounds like to parents that, yeah, the bully should get in trouble. But actually that kind of sets you up now with a vicious cycle that you're going to start. And you're actually going to instigate more bad behavior because now you're going to start instilling anger in this person that needs help instead of providing help and compassion to them.
Well, Alveus's program, I don't know if you remember back that far when we talked about it, is really about training all the people involved with the kids. And it could
be adults.
Yeah, it could be very extensive. It could be also very expensive. And a lot of continued education with the people involved. Now, I think that that's a good thing. We talked about that when we first heard about this program. I still think that that's a good thing, but I don't think it's the only answer. I still believe what Izzy has taught us, which is in the perfect world, we teach our children how to deal with, not turn the other cheek, not go get a gun, not that kind of deal with. Deal with your brain instead of with your emotions and with your overactive behavior because you're pissed. But to deal with, consider the source. Try to figure out a way, make it a game for yourself so that you can win over these people. I've talked about this before with waiting on table. You get the most horrible people that come in all the time and they're cranky, their life isn't what they want it to be, maybe they're elderly, they want things exactly just so. I would make it a game and win them over.
Right.
Just be about, okay, this is what they want, this is what I'll give them. They have to write to, in a restaurant scenario, request exactly what they want. Why shouldn't they be able to? So if I looked at it like, and not took it so personally, it was like a game for me. See if I can make these people happy because nobody else can. So if you're dealing with a friend or an enemy in a school scenario, I love just some of the looks on Izzy's face when he did some of the role acting with us at the seminar. You know, like the deal with, you're this and you're that. Two little boys in a play yard, and the other kid goes, so it kind of stops it dead in its tracks. But what he's explaining here, and he is he admires Professor Alveus. He told me that himself, and some of the things that he wants to do could make things in some ways better. And I do think it's important for everybody that's working with young people to have the kind of education that doesn't just teach them reading and writing and arithmetic. You have to have a little bit of psychology under your belt so that you can deal with the personalities of 20 different kids in your classroom. That's the only way you're going to make it if you can do that, because it's going to be really variable, especially with five-year-olds, my goodness.
The bottom line is that the adults that are involved in what's going on need to be educated as to what really works in bullying, not that they're going to step in and intercede, but that they can guide both sides of the issue, the bully and the one who's doing the bullying and the one who's being bullied, so that they can, help both of the individuals on that side of the equation so that both of them can get better.
Well, and that's the whole deal. And, of course, the way he addressed the little play acting that I did with the young girl, and I said, get away from me, quit standing next to me, you always stink, I don't want you around me, and things like that. And she says, I'm going to go tell the teacher. She tells the teacher, and in one scenario, the teacher says, well, I'm going to go get Renee, and she's going to get suspended. She can't talk to you like that. then he fed the fire. He fed the, you know. So he made her feel righteous and indignant to what I had just said to her. The other scenario, he goes over and says, is it true? Do you smell funny? And she goes, no. I take a shower every day. I don't smell funny. And he said, well, then, you know, what do you care what she said? Do you like her? No. Well, then, you know, if it's not true, then don't worry about it. And it, again, you know, her feelings are still going to be a little bit hurt by that, but she's going to go home, and she's going to think about it. She's going to ask Mom, Mom, do I smell funny? You know, my granddaughter told me a story the other day about in grade school being picked on by everybody because she always smelled like smoke because her mother would smoke in the car when she took her to school.
Oh, wow.
And out of the car and smell like cigarettes. She says, Grandma, you have no idea how much I hated that. And I said, yeah, I can relate to that when I was a kid as well. And I said, what do you do about it? And she said, well, she said, you know, I try to cover it up with perfume and things like that. And I said, I know, but it gets into your clothes. It permeates your clothes. That's what makes it so awful. And your long hair. If Mom's smoking in a closed car, I remember back in the late 70s, when in Ithaca, New York, I worked in a restaurant, and in the wintertime, sometimes people would come in and sit down at the restaurant with their winter coats on, and they just smoked a joint in their car. And I'd be like, woozy, standing next to them. It would be so bad, you know. So clothes and stuff like that do permeate those smells. So, but Crystal is still struggling with that. She just said something to me about it the other day. She said, I used to hate that. People would say to me, do you smoke? You smell just like cigarette smoke. And she was like, no, and I never would smoke. You know, so I got off on that tangent just because when I said something about smelling bad, I got a visual in my brain about her looking at me saying, God, how I hated that, Grandma. So I had to bring that up. And sometimes that is an issue for kids. But the deal here with Izzy and some of these programs is again, every time there's any kind of attention given to it, they consider it as being a plus. And I don't think that's untrue. I think that is a plus if you got somebody's attention. But I still believe that his idea of teaching a kid to only give credence, you know, where it's due, but you can't say that to a 7-year-old. They're going to say, do what? Huh? But trying to teach a kid to not be hurt by something that's obviously just something that's being said to be mean to you instead of taking it personally, and then it doesn't hurt so bad. You know that as a grown-up, right? You know that if, you know, if somebody says, what's the worst thing that could hurt me, let's use me, is if somebody calls me fat, because it's true. So that hurts me more than somebody saying I'm ugly. I'm not ugly, but I am fat. So I've never had that happen to me, by the way. I don't know why, or I learned a long time ago to not listen to other people's critiquing of me, because if you don't like me, leave me. And I've had that feeling since I was very young. So, but often it's those cuts that, you know, exist. Or, you know, Joshy, he's growing into a very fine young man. He asked me the other day, he's going in the Army, he asked me the other day, Graham, will you give me an Army haircut again? And all the kids immediately started saying, oh, God, now we're going to see those big floppy ears, and picked on him about his ears. And they've done that since he was a little boy. And he goes in the bathroom after I cut his hair, and he came out and he says, well, my ears do stick out. And I said, on the contrary. I said, you've grown into your ears just like I knew you would. Your ears don't stick out any more than anybody else's. So let go. Forget about it. But you obviously, you know, if he brought it up once he decided that he was going to go in the Army, that bugged that little boy. When he knew that he was going to go in the Army and knew he was going to have a short haircut and knew that somebody would say something about his big ears. So things like that stay with you forever. You know,
I know, even as an adult.
Exactly. It all has to do with how you learn how to deal with it. And like I told him, I said, look around you. You know, a lot of people, especially men, have got big ears. And I don't see why it's so offensive to you. And he says, well, you never got called Mickey Mouse. And I laughed, you know, and I said, no. But, you know, I've been called Goofy before. Does that count? You know, and he laughed. But it does stay inside of them. So, but learning how to deal with it, like I said, inside is the trick. That's the trick, and that's the gift that you have to seek out for yourself so that you can get past all this stuff. Now, if you've discovered that you have a program like Alveus's program in your school and it's not being as effective as you were hoping, and if your school is spending more and more effort and time trying to stop bullying than it did before, before it started to implement the program, but there's no decrease in the bullying, and as time goes by, the same kids continue to be involved in bullying situation despite all your efforts, then what you're doing is obviously not working. So then he asks the question, why? And he says, scientists speak informally of the law of unintended consequences. It means that there are likely to be unintended side effects to just about all of our actions. Gosh, how many times have we talked about that, Shelley? The ripple effect,
yep.
The butterfly effect, and it's so true, isn't it?
Yes.
This is expressed by the famous maxim, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Very
wow.
few people have bad intentions, but most of the problems in the world are caused by good intentions. When we implementing anti-bullying interventions, we are acting with the best intentions, absolutely. We want to protect children from the devastation of bullying, absolutely. But our good intentions are no guarantee that the results of our interventions will only be positive. In order to understand why our anti-bullying programs may not be successful, we need to examine the unintended negative consequences of the interventions. Now, that's a mouthful. In other words, we need to realize that if we handle everything with repercussions, there will be a butterfly effect. There will be a ripple effect. That's what repercussion means. It means when you take a drumstick and hit it on a drum, it hits it again, right? If you just loosely hold the drumstick and tap it against the top of the drum, it goes boom, 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 right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the whole idea. Once you strike it, even if you're striking it for a good reason, it's going to have reverberations. It's going to hit it two or three times. And the point he's trying to make is everything, even if it's got good intentions, even if you're doing it because you think it's going to work, and you see after several trial and errors that it's making, there's too many repercussions, and there's too many booms afterwards, then you have to that it's not working. And I still think it's a good idea to train people. I still think it's a good idea to have people aware of what's going on around them and being available. We talked about this last week with mental illness. If you are in a position to govern or be with in a school situation with a whole bunch of young kids, anything that you're doing like that, you have to be trained. You have to have a trained eye to be keeping an eye on what's going on so that we can get some intervention for kids. If you've got a kid in your class that's a continual bully, they need a lot more help than what you can imagine. You need to start paying attention. The reason for failure of an anti-bullying program may be one or more of the following. Reason number one is instructing students to inform the school staff when bullying happens. We talk about this a lot. This is the leading cause of the failure of schools to reduce bullying. Most anti-bullying programs are predicated on kids informing adults when bullying happens. There is a popular slogan in schools, telling us is not tattling. School anti-bullying laws are requiring schools to investigate, document, and report every incident of bullying. Therefore, many schools are instructing students that even if they are able to handle the bullying situation on their own, they still have to report it to the school staff. Schools are increasingly adopting anonymous bully reporting systems. There are schools today that will punish kids who observe bullying and don't tell the school authorities. Now, see, that's just silly. The good intention that comes from that is we adults need to be informed about the bullying so we can get involved to make it stop. But the unintended negative consequences from that is having kids tell authorities can only be helpful if the authorities actually know how to make the bullying stop. Without effective techniques, the reporting will have no benefit or cause more harm than good. The best legal way to get people to despise you is to tell on them to the authorities. Let's say you and I are kids in school and you've been upsetting me. Then I tell the teacher, who proceeds to send you to the principal for bullying me. Is that going to make you like me, respect me, want to be nice to me? Of course not.
Oh, absolutely no.
Yep, you will hate me, think of me as a wimp or a punk. You will want to beat me up after school. You will try to get other kids against me. You will try to make me look like scum on Facebook. You will look for opportunities to tell on me and get me in trouble for bullying you. Therefore, future incidents and probably worse incidents are almost certain to ensue. For kids to be able to deal with social difficulties, they need to develop self-confidence, self-esteem. Encouraging kids to tell adults when they are bullied gives them the message that they are not capable of handling the situation by themselves, a message that erodes their self-confidence and esteem. People find it convenient to have someone else take care of their difficulties for them. So rather than try to figure out how to deal with bullying on their own, some kids will gladly delegate this job to the school staff. A sizable percentage of kids refuse to tell the authorities, either because they are afraid of the alleged bullies will get revenge against them, and or they feel it's immoral or detestable to be an informer on their peers. Thus, any program that relies upon students informing adults about bullying is de facto limited in its ability to help.
Right.
You know, let's shift everything that he's got on this negative consequences page and put that in a workplace real quick, Shell. What do you see happening?
I was sitting here thinking that. It's so funny you say that, because I was sitting here thinking that if you have kids that rely too much on teachers and adults to fix these problems for them, they're going to grow up to be adults that can't take care of themselves. I mean, I've worked at companies where there are certain staff members that are constantly in the HR department or constantly going to their supervisor because, you know, with something as silly as, you know, somebody's not being respectful to them or somebody's picking on them, and it's like, oh my God, you know, are you 8 years old or 38? You know, I mean, you're a grown adult and you're constantly running in for assistance from the management to deal with your coworkers. And I've seen this at almost every job I've ever worked at.
Well, so let's analyze that real quick. Let's talk about if you're in a situation and you feel like your equals, your peers, the people sit beside you every day. Let's go to a factory. A factory, you have many levels of workers. You have the bosses, the people that sit upstairs in the offices with glass all around so they can watch everybody working in the factory. You have then you have the supervisors who leave the bosses in those glass encased offices and go downstairs and watch everybody firsthand and make sure everybody is being productive. And then you have the workers themselves that are doing the factory work, you know, working the machines, doing all that kind of stuff, and everybody has their own skill in a big factory like that. And then you also have the people who are, it's just their job to deliver parts, deliver all the tools needed for these people that are doing the actual factory work to be able to do their job. And then you also have another level of people who clean up in the factory and keep the floor swept and keep everything safe. And, of course, in a factory there's lots of OSHA laws and things like that. So this is also a pretty busy job as well. On each one of those levels, you have amazing peer pressure. It's not real often that those different levels, and if you think I'm wrong, we'll talk about that, but it's been my experience in the office upstairs, those people have peer pressure on down the ladder. In each realm or in each level, the peer pressure exists only in that level. What you don't see a lot of, and I know that I've seen it, but it's not as big as what the other kind of poor behavior is somebody stepping down that is on the corporate ladder higher up than you and bullying somebody in a lower station.
The only time I've ever seen. I never see it from coworker to coworker. It's always management down the ranks that it causes the most abuse. I've never seen coworker to coworker in the jobs that I've had, especially because I have worked at a couple of manufacturing plants where it was heavily laden with levels of management, and it was always each level of management that was quite abusive to the level under them, and then they were abusive to the level under them, and it like trickled down to the company. But it was always the co-workers a lot of times would kind of band together almost like they were a group of victims, because they would always be afraid of their management, and then their manager was actually afraid of the manager above them because they were getting unreasonable direction that would trickle down from the president, who would sit in his office and just bark out orders whether it could be done or not. And then you would have this trickle-down effect of these. I had the last manufacturing company I worked for, we actually had people that were getting sick left and right just from emotional stress. In 1 week, we had 4 guys that had heart attacks. And you could just see it happening because they would be so angry and frustrated. Like, how do they expect us to get this done? How do they expect that done? And then they would bark the orders out at their staff because they were just under so much unreasonable pressure, and they would lose it with the guys under them. But generally, I did not see a lot going between the actual same level employees. It was always upper management down, and I saw that at several companies.
So, your way of understanding all of this, it is definitely not so much a peer pressure as a hierarchy pressure. You're saying
and
to me
both.
That
I have seen some employees that were on the same level that just strictly didn't get along with each other. I did see some of that. But I'm talking about the abusive behavior would always come from upper management down. Now, I saw personality conflicts, which is more of the type of bullying where you're just throwing insults around, where different coworkers just didn't like each other, and then you get like these petty arguments going on. But that was usually childish and petty, where the other type of abuse would be extremely stressful to the point where even the person who was doing the bullying type of behavior was succumbing to it themselves. They would be getting sick and being under a lot of stress. So most of what I would see from coworkers that were at the same level would be petty differences because of personality conflicts, and they weren't mature enough to deal with it. And that's kind of what I was talking about when I said that I've seen people who were employees who would be constantly in the HR department, like tattling on other people because they were so immature that they couldn't handle anybody saying anything not nice to them or not being completely cooperative or getting along with them. So they would make a spectacle of themselves. I know of at least two people at this last job I had, which was down south. And HR just got so exhausted with them constantly being in the office complaining about all the other employees, they finally just let them go. It was just, like, too much. It's like, you know, they were concentrating more on how people talk to them than just sitting at their desk doing their job, you know. Who cares if so-and-so's mean to you? You're not here to have a picnic with this person. You're here to do a job. Ignore them, you know. But the fact that they cope with that and that they were always looking to management and to HR to make people be nice to them is ridiculous. And it has no place in business. But I can see that being a ripple effect on this policy of teaching kids that you have to go to the school authorities in order to deal with somebody being mean to you, and then they get out in the real world and they don't know how to deal with people being mean to them without having somebody else take care of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that certainly is a good up of the way it works in almost everything, except for, like I said, it's been my I'm coming from a management level talking about this. It seems like in my office to deal with it's usually people that are on the same level for me. But when I talked about working in a factory, I've never worked in a factory. That was my assumption as to how things went. I had lots of family members that worked in factories, my mom, my husband, my mother-in-law, my father-in-law, everybody in upstate New York. If you didn't work in a restaurant, you probably worked at Ithaca Gun, NCR, or Morris Chain, all big factories. And so there was a lot of levels in those big factories. They're very, very large factories. So what I remember from them sharing with me is usually peer pressure from their own level. I would never think that you couldn't get some shit from a higher up. I don't mean that. I mean something that's constant and chronic, because everybody's always vying, you know, to be the best in their department. So interesting that your, of course, the last place you worked, if I may say, off the record, had to be one of the most dysfunctional, most I can't believe they're still in business places I've ever heard of in my life.
Yeah.
So, it was, I think that place was kind of like in a nucleus all of its own. But
well, they,
again,
the main problem there is that they kept changing policies, and before one policy would take hold and the staff would become proficient at it, they would introduce another new policy. And the owner was one of these guys, you know, he would drive home at night and all these things would pop into his head, and then he'd come into work the next day and tell everybody to implement it without really thinking it through as to whether or not this was, like, the best way to go. And it was like nobody could ever catch their breath. You know, every couple of weeks we were changing something again. And, you can't constantly be changing things without allowing the previous work to take hold and build on that. But he was just overly imaginative without the business sense to back it up.
Well, and I guess that's probably true in a lot of cases, especially if you're one of those people that are always never giving anything a chance.
But he was also very vile, very abusive. So if he tried to implement something and he got any flack, then all these vile curse words would fly out and he'd start throwing temper tantrums. So it was kind of an abusive environment. And a couple of the managers would just kind of yes him because they were afraid of he would go off. And then they'd be sitting there trying to make something happen, and you're round table with the rest of your staff going, look, we got to make this happen. And everybody's going, well, that's not going to work. I don't want to hear it. Make it happen. You know, this is so-and-so's company. This is what we have to do. And so now you see the middle manager is annoyed because he doesn't agree with what he has to tell the staff to do. His staff is bucking it because they're like, well, this isn't going to work. What are you talking about? And it, you know, so it just causes stress on all levels. You know, but if you have an upper management that there's not open communication with, that can actually harm a company. And there was a lot of turnover there because of it.
Well, so how do we relate that kind of a scenario with what goes on in school? I mean, we could look at the levels from grades, age, things like that. I'm pretty sure that although most of the stories that we've shared on the show have been kids that are right around the same age with each other, and but there's been a few. I remember several months ago we talked about an older girl picking on a much younger girl on the bus and beating her up on the bus and everything. That was, but that's not usually what we see. We usually
right.
see, you know, same age, same grade in school and stuff like that. But let's analyze the boss you were just talking about, since nobody knows. Who do you think he was in school?
One of the bosses, there was actually a couple of bosses at this company, and was a man, one was a woman. And I think that I believe that he was always a bully because he was just too aggressive. And I believe the female, who was his sister, was bullied. I think because she was also not very nice to her staff, but I think her bullying is because she was bullied, because she was very non-confrontational. She hated confrontation. She hated having disagreements with people. But yet she was, like, really mean to her staff. I mean, most of her staff was afraid of her. When I first got hired there, I was surprised, because I knew her from a different place, and I had never seen this side of her. She was actually pretty mean to her staff, to the point where it was counterproductive, because a lot of times she couldn't get appropriate work out of her staff because they were afraid to tell her they didn't understand instructions she gave them. So now you're seeing somebody who's a bully, but I believe it's because she was bullied, because I saw her reaction sometimes to her siblings, and with a couple of them that were very, very mild-mannered. It was, you know, five siblings that ran this company. A couple of them were fairly mild-mannered, and she was actually kind of nasty to them. But the one who was the head of the whole thing, who was so aggressive with the rest of the staff, it appeared that she was afraid of him. And she was always trying to do things in a way to get his approval. And I think that led to a lot of her inappropriate behavior with her staff, because I guess she figured if she could force people into getting a good job done, somehow it would make her look good to him. But she kind of threw the rest of her staff under the bus all the time in that regard.
Well, that sounds like a major dysfunctional sibling situation, and there's a lot of that going on out there. So maybe they're not the perfect team for us to analyze, but I would say to you that it could be either one. The man that you said would leave at night and think of all these different things, always trying to make things better and everything, and just come in and just say, okay, make it so, Scotty, kind of a thing, and everybody
mm-hmm.
be scrambling to do everything. If I were to analyze him, I would say to you that he may have been the recipient of a bully, because now he is this chronic overachiever and doesn't want anybody to think that he can't do the best job ever. So I don't know. I think it would be interesting to know that. We'll never know it. And we are out of time. I real quick want to read this. Punishing bullies. Bully experts almost universally insist that bullying must not be tolerated. Schools must not let bullies get away with their actions. Many experts don't like using the word punishment and replace it with the euphemism consequences. Parents and anti-bullying organizations alike demand that schools punish bullying. School anti-bullying laws make bullying a crime, which means that bullying must be punished. Okay, we're going to leave it on that note. I think that particular paragraph needs a lot of discussion, so we'll save it for next week. I want to thank everybody. I want to remind you about what I talked about, secrets, And I want to wish you all a wonderful, wonderful, happy day today, and we'll be back tomorrow. And tomorrow we'll be having our health show with Monica and Shelley talking about holistic health. Everybody go out there and have a great day. God bless. Thanks, Shelley.
Take care, Rainey. Have a wonderful day, everyone.
Bye-bye.